And please do not block the doorway. With that, we still have a couple of members that are to show up, but we will go ahead this morning.
Madam Chair, 10 agencies have submitted reports required by statute, budget note, or emergency board direction. Item number 4 was a report required by budget note on the progress made toward the transfer of responsibility for indigent defense program from the Judicial Department to the Public Defense Services Commission. Item number 5 from Judicial Department regarding a report by budget note on the implementation of collections account established by Senate Bill 70. Item number 8, it's a report on the effects of budget reductions made to non-governmental units that receive general funds through the Department of Administrative Services. Item 10, from the Department of Administrative Services, a report on changes to the compensation plan. Item number 14, from the Department of Human Services, a report on the status of the department's reorganization. Item number 18, from the Oregon Youth Authority, a report on the Deschutes County Delinquent Youth Demonstration Project. Item number 20, from the Economic and Community Development Department, a report required by House Bill 5014 on the $120,000 provided for an evaluation of public-private partnership for beef slaughter fabrication. LFO received that report on January the 7th, and I do have a summary of that report. The proposed beef processing plant will have a state-of-the-art design, and the facility will be adaptable and efficient. And private financing for $24.2 million appears feasible, with an exception of potential investment from the Oregon Research and Technology Development account managed by the state treasurer. I do have copies of that report. Item number 21, from the Department of Veterans Affairs, a report required by budget note in House Bill 5004 for a comprehensive market rate study. Item number 25, from the Department of Environmental Quality, a report required by budget note on the progress made toward wastewater permit backlog reduction and reducing new application processing time. Item number 40, from the Department of Consumer and Business Services, a report required by ORS 656.612-5 on workers' comp premium assessment rates. The LFO recommends acknowledging all the reports.
Any questions?
Madam Chair?
Representative soon to be Senator Street.
And likewise, Madam Chair. I'd like to move that we accept the reports as presented by LFO.
Representative Schrader recommends that we accept the reports in block as described by LFO. Are there any objections? Hearing none.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Kathy Miller. I'm with the LFO office. We have 12 requests for approval of federal grants funds. The first one, number 2, is with the for the Department of Education. It is a partnership to develop a partnership with other entities to improve the K-12 math and science abilities. The actual amount of the application right now is unknown. This is a retroactive application. The application had to be submitted by January 7th. The department did inform legislative leadership on December 9th. There is no match requirement and no obligation to do any future funding. Number 13 is a $750,000 grant. It's a 3-year federal grant, and this is an opportunity for the Department of Human Services to enhance the substance abuse programs and meet prevention and early intervention for families with children from 0 to 6 years. This is a newly selected targeted population. No matches required and no obligation for continued financing. Number 17, the Oregon Youth Authority seeks grant funds of $200,000 for 2 years to help emotionally disturbed youth offenders who are moving from a closed custody facility into a family or independent living arrangement. The application is due January 22nd. There is no match requirement and no obligation for future funding. Number 22 is a federal grant opportunity for the Department of Agriculture. It's $100,000 to assess the health of streams when pesticides are used within the watershed. There is a 15% match, which will be met from the department's existing pesticide program fund. There is no obligation to continue any future funding. Number 23 is a one-time federal grant available to the Department of Agriculture for Department of Agriculture for $165,000, and this is to help offset the certification costs of farmers who become certified as organic farmers. The application was due December 31st. This is retroactive. There's no state matching requirement and no requirement for continued funding. Number 26 is a federal grant of $17,115. It's available to the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And this is a grant that would reimburse the department for its staff time in teaching $4 million, and this is to target private landowners to improve the it's an incentive program to improve the habitat for fish and other species that are at risk. This one is also a retroactive. They notified the legislative leadership on November 21st. There are two matches because this is a two-phase program, and they will both be met through internal and external sources.
Kathy, what was the reason that they couldn't have their request in at the November?
It was a timing issue. They didn't find out about it in time. Number 29 is also available to the Department of Fish and Wildlife for $898,418. This is Oregon's share of implementation of the Federal Fisheries Restoration and Irrigation Mitigation Act, and this targets fish screening projects. The state match varies according to the projects that they have, and they will meet the match with internal and external sources and in-kind projects. There's no future funding required. Number 36 is a grant available to the Department of Aviation from the Federal Aviation Administration. This one is for $959,852, which is the current expenditure limitation at this time. This is to improve the Joseph State Airport. The costs are estimated at $949,000. The Department of Aviation will fund the 10% match with their other fund revenue. There is no increased request to the expenditure limitation, and the improvements will include a full-length parallel taxiway, guidance signs, and a perimeter fencing. There's no obligation for further funding. Number 37 is a grant available to the Department of Aviation from the Federal Aviation Administration. This one is for $885,100. which is also the current federal funds expenditure limitation, and this is to improve the Condon Airport. The estimated costs are at $757,957. The department will match the 10% requirement, and the increase, there's no increase to the expenditure limitation that is required or requested. The improvements include an expanded aircraft runway and hold areas, reconstruction of a taxiway, overlay aircraft apron, install apron lightings, access road, lighted windsocks, two agricultural loading pads, and precision approach path indicators and runway end identifier lights. There is no future funding required. And the last one is a grant opportunity to the Department of Transportation for $1.76 million. This is to replace the steel deck grading on the lift span of the Broadway Bridge. The new deck will be covered with a fiber-reinforced polymer composite. And the benefits from this are to anticipated lower maintenance costs, ease of transportation and construction of modular lightweight panels, rapid assembly, higher corrosion resistance, higher load capacity, and prevent road water runoff into the river. That's the end of all the grants. The LFO recommends that you approve these requests in block, with understanding that if the funds are awarded, the agencies will return to the emergency board or the legislative assembly for approval if necessary. And of additional federal funds, expenditure limitations, and position authority.
Is there any questions or discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Schrader.
So I recommend we approve the federal grants outlined in block here, with the understanding that I'll have to come back for expenditure limitation and position authority.
Representative Schrader moves that we approve the recommendation to through Ways and Means, LFO's recommendation in block, with the understanding that the agencies will come back for expenditure limitation and FTE approval. Is there any objections? Hearing none. Cindy, would you like to carry this to full? You're going to be at full, aren't you?
Yes. I have a few no's in here, so I prefer
not. Okay. Senator Clinton?
Certainly. Mm-hmm.
Judy. The next item is Department of Administrative Services.
Item number seven. An increase requested for increase in federal expenditure limitation and grant of a 4-month extension on limited duration position.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Janine Smith from the Office of Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research, representing Dr. John Santa, who sends his regrets because of a family emergency, is not able to be here today. We're here to request the latest adjustment in limitation of OHPR needs to accommodate the grants we have received over the last 2 years. We request today an increase in limitation related to our HRSA grant that Oregon received in October of 2000. At that time, we requested and received limitation for the 99-01 biennium and later limitation for the remainder of the grant in the 01-03 biennium. The HRSA grant work was done predominantly from November of 2000 to December of 2001, laying the groundwork for subsequent Medicaid and FEOP work. HRSA provided some additional funds in Oregon in late 2001 for which the limitation was granted. During 2002, we completed several small projects. The grant is in its final 3 months, with one staff person completing a couple of projects and writing the final report to the federal government that's due March 31st. In the course of completing the closing financials, we realized that some work thought to be completed in the 99-01 biennium had actually been completed in the 01-03 biennium. As a result, we need the requested additional limitation in this biennium. Essentially, we are asking to shift the limitation from 99-01 to 01-03. All the dollars involved are federal dollars, and they replace general fund. There has been no increase in the size of the grant, and no additional work is being done as a result of this shift. And we appreciate your attention to this.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I'm Mike Wolfong, the Operations Manager for the Office of Oregon Health Policy Research. Essentially, I just wanted to identify myself for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Cora Parker with the Budget and Management Division, and we recommend approval of the request.
LFO. We also recommend approving the request.
So, Madam Manager.
Question, Madam Chair.
Deputy Schrader.
Well, I assume this was anticipated then, the grant being able to move, as you've outlined here. I assume that was anticipated. This is not totally new news. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, essentially what it's more of a bookkeeping issue where we anticipated expenditures in last biennium that actually took place in this biennium, which caused them the expenditure limitation to be used up in this biennium.
And do you expect the federal government to allow that bookkeeping change to go?
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, yes. Okay. We have their support.
Just may I make a comment, Madam Chair, real quick?
Representative Schrader.
You know, we've had to make some very, shall we say, awkward decisions here at eBoard in the last couple of sessions. So I would hope that we've had some problems legally in doing some of the things we'd like to do, particularly with the OHP2 waiver. We've got these things set out, perhaps inadvertently, in big, huge blocks of dental, A&D, mental health, chemical dependency. I would hope that part of the work that would be done and is anticipated or had been anticipated was an opportunity to break that out a little bit in more thoughtful, discrete elements so that when we have to make more cuts, probably, this upcoming session, that we can do so with not the butcher block type approach that we've had to apparently use. So, because a lot of advocates, a lot of people out here would like, I think, the opportunity to inform us as to, you know, what they're all important, but what are the top priorities? And we need to have that sort of leeway to do thoughtful decisions here in the state of Oregon. So I hope you're going to tell me that that's part of your workload.
The HRSA grant was laid a lot of the groundwork for the work on the benefits package through the Health Services Commission and did a lot of other information, things that fed into the waiver application steering committee. We've done small community research around the state on Medicaid, what's going on in Medicaid. We've looked at Washington State's cost sharing and premium payments. All that has fed into the whole process of the OHP2 redevelopment and some work with the FIAT program in terms of getting the message out to the people of what's available and getting education within OMAP and FIAT. This particular grant is not focused specifically on what you're asking, but we're finishing this one up. We have some other...
I assume you'll carry that message home to the department and
yes,
let them know that that's a top priority for this coming legislature.
I would like to just echo Representative Schrader that in your conversation with the feds that's an area that we would like to be able to revisit and an area that we would like to make a little more flexible so that we're not in the position of having to do making some decisions that we really would not like to make. And I think all of us, I think everyone on this panel would agree. So in your conversation with the federal government, you have that kind of dialogue with them so that during the regular session that can actually be an item that can be addressed.
Yes,
yes, ma'am.
We'll include that in our report.
With that, Representative Menis moves that we send to the full Ways and Means the approval of the request of Administrative Service, the Oregon Health Plan, to work. Is there any objection? Hearing none. Representative Menis, would you like to hear that?
Next agenda item is Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, number 35.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lee.
I would like to express appreciation for the progress report regarding the fish deformity study. This is a real concern to...
This one.
This is a real concern to all of us, having a high proportion of deformed fish, especially in the Newburgh Pool area.
Yes.
So, Dr. Curtis is... professor and head of the Environmental and Molecular Toxicology Department in OSU, and Mr. J. Nicholas is from Water Enhancement Board, and we are very happy they are here to make the presentation. And if I might, I'd like to introduce in the audience that there are people in the audience that come a long way to listen to this presentation. Tom Long, Chair of Citizens for Safe Water. Kathy Newcomb, Vice Chair of Safe Water Organization. Bob Newcomb, a member of the Safe Water Drinking Water Organization. And Dr. Charles Scott, a toxicologist, and also a member of the Safe Water Organization. And I want to express a welcome.
Thank you, Senator Yee. Welcome. And I know that Senator Yee has been a real champion on this particular issue and has worked very hard. And so we welcome you being here.
Madam Chair, I, for the record, I'm Jeff Huntington, the director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and Jay Nicholas came today and has been the principal person working on it. And Senator Yee, I know you were looking right at him when you had introduced him, and that's just fine.
The light's bad from here out.
I came today just to, since this issue in our agency does not usually appear before this committee, to give a little bit of context for the study and to provide the continuity going into the next session, because I believe it'll be attached to many discussions we have about watershed enhancement issues in the Willamette. This project, OWEB is a small agency, and we essentially act as a foundation that administers a grant program to fund voluntary projects. And this is a result of a partnership that we had with the 2001 legislature and with Senator Yee in particular to frame a research effort to examine the cause of fish deformities in the Willamette River. OWEB's role in this was to work with the Oregon Natural Resources Institute to frame the questions to be answered by the research and to work to make sure the policy objectives of Senator Yee and the legislature were met by the budget and the questions that were being asked of the research ultimately to be done and to administer the contract. So we framed the contract for $500,000 and oversaw the awarding of the contract to Dr. Curtis at OSU. And at this point, Dr. Curtis is about halfway through the field work of the study. And at the request of the committee, we came here today to provide you a status report. And OWEB will continue to oversee the contract and work to conclusion and work with Dr. Curtis to provide the final reporting of results to all of the agencies that are involved in the legislature and so the policy issues can be examined upon the conclusion of his work. Jay Nicholas, that Senator Yee introduced, is the person that helped frame the questions for the research and is working with Dr. Curtis to kind of be the linkage between the research and the policy issues that are at hand. So if you have any questions on the contract or any of those, Jay and I are here. Otherwise, we'll step back and let Dr. Curtis go through the content of his work. Thank you very much.
Dr. Curtis.
Good morning. My name is Lawrence R. Curtis. I am a professor and head of the Department of Environmental and Molecular Toxicology at Oregon State University. I've got copies of the testimony for you that we'll have available for you. Several OSU faculty, including myself, responded to a call for research proposals issued by the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board in the fall of 2001. The research question was, is the observed incidence of fish deformities in the Willamette River related to variation in ecosystem conditions, especially natural and human-induced aspects of water and sediment chemistry. The OSU proposal was funded after peer review handled by Oregon Sea Grant Program. Work began in April 2002 that focused on Newberg Pool and an upstream reference site near Corvallis. A progress report was completed on December 12, 2002 and submitted to OWEB. I am here today to briefly summarize our progress to date. There is a high prevalence of skeletal deformities in juvenile fish from Newberg Pool. Despite sampling that spanned 10 years, no scientifically based explanation developed. This project addresses this issue and consists of two field seasons, spring and summer of 2002 and 2003, and year-round laboratory work. Sampling for one field season is complete, but many laboratory analyses are still in progress. This report summarizes progress to date and provides no conclusions. It does identify findings of interest. Almost 18,000 juvenile fish were collected and x-rayed for the 2002 field season. The x-rays were read, scored, and entered in a database for 25% of this total by December the 12th, 2002. That's the date we prepared the progress report. Almost all the data analyzed to date were for northern pike minnow. Field collections in spring, summer of 2002 confirmed about a threefold higher prevalence of backbone deformities in juvenile fish in Newberg Pool compared to the Willamette River near Corvallis. Corvallis was selected as a reference site, that is a comparison, since low prevalence of backbone deformities was consistently reported here. Histopathological examination of the deformed vertebrae and spines were associated with parasites in some instances. Histopathology was conducted on about 140 northern pike minnow for more precise description of lesions and for the detection of associated pathogens not readily cultured. Most of the skeletal lesions were associated with chronic inflammatory changes in cysts of a parasite related to the organism that causes whorling disease in trout and salmon. No bacteria or viral pathogens were isolated from deformed vertebra or spine, vertebral spines. General physical and chemical characteristics of water, including temperature, pH, dissolved oxygen, and nitrate, were similar at Newberg Pool and in the Willamette River near Corvallis. General water chemistry and physical conditions were measured 24 hours a day and 7 days a week at locations from May through July of 2002. This was accomplished with electronic sensors deployed approximately 1 foot from the river bottom. Two units were deployed on opposite banks of Newberg Pool, and the third slightly upstream from Corvallis, that's Kiger Island, is more precise location. We also looked at contaminants. Concentrations of the metals cadmium, copper, lead, and zinc were also similar at these two sites, with the exception of one high zinc sample from Newberg Pool. Very low concentrations of persistent organic contaminants were detected in water from Newberg Pool and near Corvallis. The data analyzed by December 12th indicated some persistent organic contaminants were two to fourfold higher in Newberg Pool. These are legacy issues, banned contaminants, all at less than one part per trillion, DDT and breakdown products from DDT, PCBs, and the banned organochlorine contaminant, dieldrin, but again, very low concentrations. Early life stage experiments with zebrafish, in which we exposed them to Willamette River water collected from Newberg Pool and near Corvallis and well water. In a number of experiments, newly fertilized eggs were exposed for 15 to 47 days, and we looked at skeletal development using a fluorescence microscopy. Scoring criteria were defined in development, rates of survival. No consistent differences were detected in fish raised in the Newberg Pool water and that near Corvallis. We're continuing to work on that methodology. Overall, results obtained to date suggest identification of scientifically based hypotheses for causes of high prevalence of backbone deformities are feasible within the scope of the project. We're just a little over half a year into this, and I think it's going quite well, and I think we'll have useful information at the end of this. It'll really focus and perhaps provide some good insights into the problems in Newburgh Pool.
Representative Schrader.
Just two questions, if I may. Again, look, I appreciate the work. It's very interesting. I agree with Senator Yee. It would seem that one of the future pieces you want to work on is the relationship between the parasite and intermediate host, vis-a-vis the organic contamination, do some independent studies to verify that there is that relationship. And then I assume the reason the state of Oregon's interested in this is we're worried about humans. And so it'd be interesting to know if indeed this is something that's going on, does it require major change, or does it just mean that any fish that would be caught in that particular section of the river should be obviously cooked, and that would maybe take care of the parasite as far as us having any particular problem whatsoever? Then the other issue that I'm kind of curious about, be interesting to see, even though the parts per it's less than parts per trillion for dieldrin and DDT and all that, you know, are certain fish species that much more susceptible? Perhaps that work's already been done, but that would be interesting to follow up on, considering that's one of the few differences between the two pools.
Yeah, first, in terms of the pathogen, Representative Schrader, it's very specific for cyprinid fishes, so I don't think that pathogen poses no human health risk itself.
Good.
And related to the other contaminants, we are doing additional studies. We're actually looking at tissue for these contaminants, and you're correct. There's quite a bit of data that we can look at these tissue concentrations. And we're also prepared. We find something that's a potential problem, we're within the scope of the current project, we're prepared to test those chemicals in these related fish that we grow in the laboratory to see if anywhere near these concentrations we would see deformities develop in the laboratory.
Great.
That's really the scoping in the field, and then things we identify we'll examine under controlled conditions in the laboratory. And that's the scope of the project.
Great. Mm-hmm.
Senator Yee. Thank you. So when you look into the chemicals contents in the river, will you be able to tell whether it has any particular effects on human health?
Well, we can look at the concentrations of the way chemicals are regulated in drinking water is through levels that are set that are called maximum contaminant levels. And of course, we're looking at source water. And when one looks at maximum contaminant levels for doing human health risk assessment, you want to look at the product water from the treatment plant.
Mm-hmm.
So our data could do one thing that would be useful, I think, for the drinking water question is if chemicals show up that might be of concern, we could identify those for the drinking water plant, and then they could test those specifically and narrow their scope, make it a much more tenable analytical problem. Instead of looking for a needle in a haystack, we could focus that for sources in the source water. But you'd really need to look at the drinking water per se to take that on directly.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. So ultimately, we are very concerned. The bottom line is we are concerned about the relations of deformity in fish to human health. So when you see any levels of chemicals that could be above normal levels, will you be working with the water treatment plant in Wilsonville to analyze the effect, whether it has any possible harm to human?
Well, we'll share when we get all the results from this year, we'll share those results with personnel at the drinking water plant. When we haven't completed all the analyses, we have the complete set, we'll share that information. If they need assistance with higher sensitivity methods, we would be glad to assist them with detection and developing methods and working with them on that.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up question. So if at any point you decide that continuation of this project is needed in order to analyze the effect on human health, when do you think you have an idea? Because funding has to be made during the session, before end of June or before the session. So you need to find out whether there's any relations and whether you need to continue the study and what is the funding needed during the session or before the middle of the session in order for you to come in with the request to the Water Enhancement Board and to the legislature.
Yeah, I think the water analyses are well along now. I believe we'll have the analytical results from the water testing that we did in February, and we would discuss this with personnel at the water treatment plant, and if there's anything of concern, we would share that information and move forward from there. But until we get those results, it's premature to move on that. But we're moving quickly. Actually, I was in the lab the other day and asked one of the technicians about another issue, and he said, my boss has got me nailed to this machine. I can't go anywhere until I get these results. So we're moving. We're very focused on getting. We want to be done with this before we start the next field season because we can't afford to get backlogged.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and Senator, I might add that that's...
Would you state your name for the record, please?
Jeff Huntington, the Director of the Watershed Enhancement Board. That's one of the roles that the Watershed Enhancement Board can also play, is we have an aggregated source of funds through Measure 66 and federal dollars that, as long as we continue to administer those, we can accept and work on funding research projects on a year-round basis in session time and after sessions in. So we'll be rolling up results and working to see what the next step is as well.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, while legislature is very concerned with this issue, and we want you to keep the legislature informed about any need for continuation and the funding so we can all work together. I won't be here next session, but I'm sure all the senators from the Newburgh, Wilsonville, Tualatin, all those areas are very concerned with this issue. So please keep all of us informed. I have one more question. Madam Chair, when will the final report be made?
The final report is due June 30th, 2004. That will be for both field seasons. So it gives me about 3 or 4 months after the second round of analytical results are prepared to write the report and make sure all the data is completely analyzed.
Did you say June 2004?
June 30th, 2004. Yes, mm-hmm. For after the second field season.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee. This is Sapi Chapazia with the Department of Administrative Services. We recommend that you acknowledge receipt of this report.
Thank you.
We'll also recommend this acknowledge and receipt of the report.
Senator Yee, you get to make the motion this morning.
Thank you. I move that we acknowledge the receipt of the progress report.
Senator Yee moved that we acknowledge receipt of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement report on toxins in the Newburgh Pool of the Willamette River.
And thank them for the excellent work.
Thank you for your excellent work. And I know that we will look forward to the completion of the report. But I would also say if there is any indication that there is some adverse impact on health, that you would get to us prior to 04. It's approved. Senator Yee, would you carry?
I'd be happy to.
Our next item is 41, State Board of Nursing.
Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Representative Chair Winters and members of the committee. I'm Joan Bouchard. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon State Board of Nursing. On my right is Pat Miles. She's the Business Manager for the Board of Nursing. And on my left is Adam Torkelson, who is the Budget Analyst for the Board of Nursing. We're here today to request increased limitation for two separate issues for the Board of Nursing. The first issue is the Attorney General's budget. As you know, the Board of Nursing has the
has the duty to respond to complaints regarding licensees in a responsible and expedient manner. And it's been the policy of the agency to use the Attorney General's services in a proactive way so that we can ensure that our actions are sound and legally defensible. As a result, few of the Board of Nursing decisions in its 92-year history have been appealed to the courts. And in the last 20 years, which is the time that we are aware of, no board of decision have been overturned by the courts. The Board settles about 99% of its cases, its disciplinary cases, by stipulated agreement. However, we prepare for about 15 hearings per year, and we actually conduct about 5 to 6 hearings per year. For the cases that do go to a hearing, few subsequently go beyond a hearing, and in fact, until this biennium, it's been over 10 years until any cases have been appealed to the court. However, this year, we have had 2 cases that have been appealed to the appellate court, and it has increased our attorney general fees substantially. Because it's so unusual that cases go to the court, they're not part of our agency budget. So each biennium budget is calculated with the same base numbers of AG hours increased only by the Department of Justice hourly rates, and usually this amount is sufficient to cover routine businesses. But we are unable to absorb the extra cost of these courses that are appealed to the appellate court. This is the second time this biennium we've had to request an increase to our limitation for AG expenses. This current case that we're coming before you today came to the board's attention in June 2002 and was serious enough to warrant an emergency suspension of a licensee. To date, this case has cost the agency over $50,000 in AG services, and further costs are anticipated. The board's final order has just been released, and we anticipate that it's going to be appealed. And this case has become even more complex because the licensee has filed a lawsuit in federal court against the board members as an entity and against each individual board member. Although the U.S. District Court in Oregon dismissed the case, the licensee has appealed the case to the Ninth Federal Circuit Court in San Francisco. So that's going to entail more attorney general fees. Individuals have, of course, the right to contest board decisions, but at the same time, the board must adequately defend its decisions. And this is important to the state, as the outcome of this or any court case can set case law for future decisions.
The quick question. Did you use the hearing panel in this process for these two cases?
Yes, we do. We have begun to use the hearing panel.
But at least 2 particular cases was the hearing panel.
The second one it was, the first one was
first
not.
One it was
right.
Not.
We had not started using the hearing panel yet. But this one, yes, we did use the hearings panel on this one.
Do you have any, because these were disputed, non-disputed cases, have you any comparable data as to whether it's costing you more or less going through this new process, the hearing panel process?
Madam Chair, I'm Pat Miles, the business manager for the Board of Nursing. At this point, basically, it's more anecdotal than actual. Our hearings officer costs have gone down. The hourly rate is lower, and they do seem to be efficient in that manner. We have seen an increase in AG costs in rewriting final board orders, and that's where we're seeing our costs. We haven't done an actual analysis because each case is so individual in actual costs. However, we do know that writing the final order on this present case took in excess of 30 AG hours.
Does the AG's office represent you at the hearings panel?
Yes, ma'am.
And does the So then they still represent you there. Do you have the same AG that you've had all along, or have you had new AGs, a new person to represent you?
Madam Chair, we do use a variety of assistant attorney general staff. However, we do have one primary assigned for hearings cases, and I believe he's been working with us for 3 years.
Approximately
3 years. and we have a separate attorney, assistant attorney general, who works with us on administrative law type issues, general advice, and he's been with us for the same period of time. So the two of them confer on these issues.
Senator Farnum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At any time during this, were there settlement agreements offered?
Chair Winters, Senator Carno, yes, there have been settlement offers made during this period of time.
Accepted.
Is correct. Mm.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Second one is actually a success story because we have to come to you for budgetary expenditure authority, increased budgetary expenditure authority because of the increase of nursing assistants who want to become certified in the state of Oregon, and that's a good thing. And that's a success story for the long-term care industry, and it increases our revenue. However, it has affected our budgetary authority. Expenditure authority. The Board of Nursing, as you know, is responsible for testing and certifying nursing assistants. CNAs, certified nursing assistants, are a vital element of the workforce in both long-term care and in hospitals. By federal law, all nursing assistants must become certified within 4 months of their employment as nursing assistants or be reassigned to other duties. And for most people, if they don't get certified within 4 months, that would mean losing the job. So with the economy and the nursing assistant shortage crisis, keeping the door open for us to be able to test candidates is crucial. The CNA program is a federally subsidized program. For every dollar we collect from the testing candidate or for the employee, we receive a matching dollar for Title 19 Medicaid funding through the Department of Human Resources to pay for the testing services. So this means that we're getting the revenues, and they continue to grow as long as our testing expenditures also grow. In 1999, the administration of the nursing assistant test was outsourced for the first time. At that time, based on estimated volume, a budget of $798,840 was established for conducting testing. The first three quarters of the 1999-01 biennium indicated we would not use that amount, and the 01-03 biennium budget was reduced to $715,621. However, the first three quarters of this biennium have proved to be the opposite of the 99-01 biennium. Higher volumes have become the norm. For example, in fiscal year 99-2000, we were giving an average of 187 written and 263 skills tests per month. But in the past 6 months, the average number of tests per month has grown to 343 written and 415 skills. 415 skills examinations. And in fact, when we did a flatline projection to the end of the biennium, today it would be, the cost of the program would be $972,767. This is about $72,990 higher than even with the September data we used in developing our request. And this is about a 36% increase over the current budget.
Since this is higher, do you have new adjusted budget figures for us today?
Madam Chair, we have a handout that is available. It may have been given to you already. This was updated based on the latest invoice we had, which was through mid-December, and that's why the numbers are so high.
Okay.
As you can see, the CNA testing is a significant part of our budget. It's 19% of our budget, so the impact on this item is significant for us, and we can't absorb it within the 01-03 budget that we have. So we're asking, we have the revenue, and it's a good thing because more people are wanting to be nursing assistants, and we need them out there in the workplace, but we need the, and we don't have to raise fees to get it, but we need the increased expenditure authority in order to continue to test these people that want to become nursing assistants.
Question on your spreadsheet, you have a category that says written no shows. Is that the individual who didn't show up for the test?
Madam Chair, Pat Miles again. Yes, in fact, this is why we had trouble pinning down our initial numbers when we outsourced. We have to pay, of course, if the testing service schedules a person and the person fails to give notice with within 24 hours of not showing up, or before 24 hours. When we went into this project, our no-show rate before we outsourced was 30%. This was across the board, across the state. Month to month, it was pretty consistent. So in the very middle of that spreadsheet, you see a percentage of no-shows, and you can see another success story. We have only about 10% of the people not showing up. People are very interested in completing the process now, far more so than they were 2 years ago. And I think that that's a really good reason why we're seeing higher costs.
Thank you. So I said, I think that's a good thing because, you know, the pay now for CNAs are higher, and there's a lot of job opportunities out there for them. So there's a real interest in completing this and getting certified because they know they can get jobs out there.
Well, this panel discussed it, I think, at great length, right. The need to address the issue of the shortage of nurses in the state of Oregon, including the CNN, and particularly as it related not only to the hospitals and other, but also to the assisted living facilities and the nursing home industry. So I'm really pleased to see that the no-shows are sticking with it and that you're seeing more individuals that are wanting to be in that employment field. It is one that I think we've talked about, that the need is great, and that had we had individuals who had taken the test and who had gone through school, that we could put something like 1,800 people to work. And so I'm pleased to see that the testing and that is coming forward.
LFO.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. The department, Adam Torgerson from the Department of Administrative Services. We recommend approving the request as updated, which would add $72,990 for the updated CNA costs, bringing the total request to $337,146 of other funds expenditure limitation.
LFO.
LFO also recommends approving the request for additional expenditure elimination as updated to $337,146. Other funds.
Representative Schrader.
Madam Chair, I move that we approve the request.
Representative Schrader moves that we approve the request as recommended by LFO. Is there any objections? Hearing none. Thank you very much. And I'll keep it.
Thank you.
Before we... you may go to the next person. I want to give a thank you to her, and that's Senator Yee, who will not be with us next time, but I think she will be out there keeping us on our toes. this is, as subcommittee, this will be Senator Yee's last official subcommittee member action of Ways and Means, and she has probably the one individual that I've known and had the pleasure to work with that has talked more about the need for performance measures and accountability in this building than I think any other legislator. We're going to miss that because we have to be reminded, I think all of us, that it is important that the dollars and the programs that we're involved in are actually being not only serving the needs of our communities, but are done in a way that are efficient and responsible. So, Senator Yee, I want to personally just today say thank you for all of your hard work, and thank you for keeping all of us on our toes. And I know that this is not that you will be back to remind us, because I know you well enough to know that you have the heart of Oregon. In Oregon is in your heart, and service to people is in your heart. And with that, Senator Yee, I know you can, we're going to hear from you this morning.
Yes, and I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for all your help. We may not agree all the time, but this is democracy, and only in America we have such wonderful privileges. Thank you. made a call. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I am State Senator Mei Yi, representing Senate District 15. A motion adopted by the full emergency board in November stated that an oversight committee be appointed to review DHS RFP for services to medically fragile persons with developmental disabilities, as well as the bidding process to provide their services. The Oversight Committee is to report to the January 2003 meeting of the Emergency Board on its work. An Oversight Committee was not appointed by leadership, but there was general support for a one-person committee to gather further information, review DHS proposed RFQP request for qualified providers, which was enclosed in Bobby Mink's October 15, 2002 letter to the co-chairs of the emergency board, and report its findings to the January emergency board. And I'm here to present the report. I received most of the data I requested from DHS Mental Health Senior and Disabled Services, with the exception of client care plans and visitation to the homes. From the information I gather, I believe that savings from privatization could be significant. For example, in one of the medical state-operated group homes, it costs $112,114 per month for only three clients. There is a staff of 21 in this group home, a staff to client ratio of 7-1. Each client costs $1,245 per day, $37,371 per month, $448,458, almost $500,000 per person per year. This does not even include the cost of special food and drugs. One of the three clients requires special food imported from Europe, as well as two medications that cost $6,000 and $7,000 per drug per month. The cost per client in state-operated medical group home averages $19,000 per month, as stated by Mr. Mink in his October 15 letter. Community medical group homes are providing care at a range of $8,900 to $12,500 per client per month. Even using the high end of the range of $12,500, there's huge potential for savings. Nine medical homes times five residents times 24 months times $6,500 would yield a potential biannual savings of $7.07 million total funds, or at 40% general fund, $2.8 million. Although DHS claims the state-operated community group home, SOCP, is caring for clients of much higher acuity levels, they will not release care plans even without identifying names, nor will they allow visits to these group homes. One can help question DHS reasoning that only state-operated group homes are capable of providing for clients of higher acuity. Oregon is in a severe budget crisis, We are facing a $2 billion revenue shortfall next biennium. We are cutting mental health, alcohol and chemical dependency treatment programs and nursing home rates, which may cause the closure of nursing homes, displacing many frail and disabled seniors. Why isn't the department proposing efficiency measures in programs where there can be significant savings? The $2.8 million general fund potential savings could be used for preserving many of our high-priority programs from deeper cuts. The perceived legal issues DHS stated could be addressed, as mentioned in my November 6th letter. The documents provided by Mr. Mink in no way suggest that the U.S. Department of Justice concerns itself with whether care for medically fragile individuals is provided by a state employee or a private sector employee. In fact, U.S. Department of Justice ruled that the quality of care of Oregon's community services system be appropriate to each individual's need and that it be monitored by the state to ensure that services are adequate. Community providers are now providing care to medically fragile clients, and other states have privatized these types of services without federal intervention. Also addressed in my November 6th letter is DHS' other concern relating to the state's capacity to maintain a backup system. Backup services to individuals who are in medical crisis in the MRDD community are already provided for in the SOCP's 3 5-bed facilities. This is included in the RFQP. The only difference is that backup services will then be provided by private sector employees. DHS has not been responsive to legislature's request to improve efficiencies and reduce costs in the state-operated community program. During the 2001 session, a budget note was written for a third-party reviewer to examine staffing levels and other operating costs in state-operated medical group homes for developmentally disabled persons. The primary issue in this report was whether SOCP can be privatized to save money. The report makes no examination of staffing levels and other operating costs in SOCP, nor comparison to other community group home providers. Although it did reference high medical and supply costs and occupational therapist rates. The reviewer stated the state-operated medical homes as exemplary and praised excursions to the Columbia River Gorge on the Stern Wheeler and to the coast with available staff to accompany clients with tracheotomies on a regular basis. DHS convened a committee to assist in the review of the report that included program administrators, parents of clients, and employee union representatives. When complaints were raised regarding the conflict of interest of some of the members on this review committee, the committee was abruptly disbanded. The budget note also asked MHDDSD to work with the community developmental disability group home providers to review staffing and other costs in its state-operated group homes and propose alternatives to a state-operated adult crisis home scheduled to open July 2002. MHDDSD, the Mental Health and Disabled and Senior Services Division, was to report to the Emergency Board on the work group's findings and recommendations no later than April 2002. The work group was never formed. No alternative was proposed. The adult crisis group home did did not open after all due to budget shortfall. The June Emergency Board directed MHDDSD to seek competitive bidding from private sector providers for medical services currently offered through state-operated group homes for persons with developmental disabilities and report to the November meeting. 5 months later, at the November Emergency Board meeting, DHS again reported perceived legal problems and marginal savings without seeking competitive bids from the private sector. In the RFQP proposed by DHS to be used if Emergency Board approves seeking competitive bids for privatization, the rate per client is recommended at $8,500 per month to provide residential and employment-based services. $8,500 is only 45% of the state's average cost. I strongly question DHS seriousness in implementing the legislature's direction, if and when it is given, by limiting rates to less than half of its own average cost. The RFQP is destined to failure because of the suggested low funding. It is hoped that the new director of DHS will be responsive to legislature's request to improve efficiencies and accountability and reduce cost in the state-operated community program. According to information in the University of Minnesota study entitled Residential Services for Persons with Developmental Disabilities, Status and Trends Through 2000, Oregon's daily average rate for care in state MRDD facilities is the second highest in the nation, as depicted in Table 1.9, average per resident daily expenditures in state MRDD settings and psychiatric facilities in fiscal year 2000 by state. See attachment. I've provided a chart. And this study reports that the national average is 296.22 per day for homes with 1 to 6 residents. Oregon's cost is $582 per day, almost twice as much, and only second to New Hampshire. If we can improve efficiency and reduce costs for the medical state-operated group homes, we can also do the same with the behavioral group homes, as other states are doing, and bring in additional potential savings of $17.3 million per biennium or $7 million general fund. I would recommend that the new director of DHS review the high staffing level and costs of the state-operated group homes and compare those with the private community group home rates and costs of other states' ICFMR programs and propose how services and supplies can be provided more efficiently at less cost to the next legislature and new governor as soon as possible. And I thank you for the opportunity to make this report.
Thank you, Senator Yee. The director, Jean Thorne, is in the audience if she cares to come up.
I have asked Director Jean Thorne to meet with me at 10 o'clock this morning to go over some of our concern with her, and I asked her, I have said to her that I'm going to include her in my report, that she will be involved in reviewing the situation and propose alternative to the next legislature.
Well, since she will have the responsibility of all these reports and all these issues, and I didn't know whether Jean would like to comment on the report or not. Jean.
Madam Chair, Jean Thorne, Acting Director of the Department of Human Services. Senator, you did contact me a couple of days ago to give me a heads up on this, and I said I thought it was very appropriate to ask that we relook at this issue. I have to say I've been there a week, and so I have not had an opportunity to look into this at this point. As Senator Yee said, I'll be meeting with her later today, and we'll be happy to come back during the 2003 session and report on this.
Jean, as you look at this issue, and Senator Yee had pointed out staffing levels and so on, would you also look at how much of that is our benefit cost, like health and PERS and those kinds of issues that's driving to where we're at such a higher level than the rest of the country?
Certainly.
Madam Chair.
Senator Turner.
And Jean, I appreciate the fact you've only been here a week, although I always think of you as managing an awful lot of these agencies. So I think one of the things that would help us is to understand why the agency's been non-compliant before your arrival and why the resistance to provide Senator Yee the information and to certainly let this legislative panel and the rest of the body understand why there's some reason that we can't put this in the private sector if at all possible.
Certainly. Okay. Thank you. And again, thank you for all your hard work, Senator Yee, and I know you will continue to monitor this particular issue, and we encourage you to do so. And this panel will accept your report, and you will, and I will take the liberty that you will give this report to full.
It'll be my pleasure.
Thank you. This is our last official meeting, and I just want to take the opportunity to thank this panel. It has been, you've had some extremely difficult tasks to do in this budget environment. Have had to make some decisions that certainly I think that some of us have gone home and really agonized and cried over. But you have been there with me, and I want to thank you, and I want to thank you all for your hard work. I know that we will take some of these issues with us into the legislative session, those of us who will continue to be here. And like I said, Senator Yee, although she will not be on this panel, she will be in this building both in spirit and as well as physically, I'm sure, to not only to continue to remind us of our responsibility to the citizens of the state of Oregon, but also on those issues that she cares so passionately about. I could not leave this today without giving you my thanks. And also those of you who have, in the audience, who have worked with us and who care about what happens to the citizens in the state of Oregon. We are in a climate that is in budget crisis. I think all of us recognize that. And we would just ask for, to continue to provide us with suggestions. I mean real sincere suggestions. We too, on this side of the aisle, need your input. We don't have all the answers, but not just to tell us and to criticize us, but we look for ways to solve problems. I often say that it's sometimes it's the person that is at the lowest end that can tell us really how we can do things better, and we encourage that kind of input from you. With that, and I want to thank Mr. Britton, who has a tremendous responsibility as our legislative fiscal office and who has seen us through these crises. And I want to personally thank you and for your availability. And with that, I will adjourn, and we'll see you tomorrow.